Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. It has been a long slog out of the Great Recession, but there are signs, perhaps weak signs, but signs nonetheless that employers are starting to pick up the pace of hiring. The U.S. Labor Department reports the number of job openings across the nation in June stood at a four-year high. Since then, however, there are other reports that indicate hiring has slowed. This hour, we'll take a look at the Central Ohio job picture. We'll try to figure out where the openings are, what training and skills employers are looking for, and what you can do to find the jobs and get them. We welcome back Doug Buchanan, Managing Editor for Business First here in Columbus. Welcome, Doug.
Good morning.
Doug, are Central Ohio employers, companies in a hiring mood?
I think increasingly you are seeing some signs of optimism. It depends on the industry, obviously, but there are definitely pockets of hiring out there. Now that we're coming into the fall, it's not too early to start talking about seasonal work. And obviously, a lot of companies always pin their hopes on a strong spending by consumers for the holidays, and I think that they would like to ramp up hiring to be ready for that in case it happens.
What's fueling the optimism? Is it the healthcare law settlement by the Supreme Court? Is there more certainty in the marketplace right now?
Well, I think there's definitely certainty in the market, but again, another thing is just simply pent up demand. You have everybody out there wanting this malaise to end, and for consumers to start getting confident and consumers to start spending, and for the economy to just get moving. And I think you're starting to see that particularly in autos, so that Ohio's manufacturing sector is starting to come back. And as that, hopefully will build on other industries, and you'll start to see some other industries, taking advantage of that and starting to come back as well.
One of the great economic indicators that I use is just the temporary license plates on cars. I mean, for 2 years, 2008, 2009, you hardly saw any of those white cardboard plates
right
on the back of new cars. Now, you're starting to see, a little bit more of them.
And you're starting to see the manufacturers, the auto plants, hiring and particularly investing in expansions and remodelings, and that's going to trickle down into the suppliers. You're seeing a lot of hiring at auto suppliers. And they really, I think, the auto manufacturers, not only are they enjoying a bump in sales right now, but as you said, car sales were way down for a couple of years. And so there's a lot of people driving some rather old cars, and they're thinking that this year is really only the start. And it's going to be really the next couple of years where you're going to see car sales really even take off even more. So they need to be ready for that.
Yeah, some people like yours truly is driving a 1997 car with 200,000 miles on it.
Wow.
But it's still going. Anyway, our question for you, are you looking for a job? What is your take on the jobs picture? Are you an employer? Do you have openings? What is your take on the labor pool? Give us a call, 292-8513, 292-8513. Our email is allsides@wosu.org. You can also reach us on Facebook and by Twitter. Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Katrina Roby is Business Development Manager for Dawson Careers, a staffing firm here in Columbus. Katrina, what are you seeing? What are your clients telling you?
What we're seeing in the marketplace currently is increased hiring. A lot of times our summer months are sometimes quiet. This summer has been very steady and increasing each month with hiring demands. We're seeing a lot of hiring demands in the call center arena. We are also seeing a lot in just entry-level marketing positions, HR. The IT field is starting to hire quite frequently again, and it's those candidates in that marketplace are starting to, are becoming harder to identify.
When you see hiring in the entry-level sector, what does that tell you what's going on inside the company?
I think a lot of companies, if you look at it, a lot of companies are reporting, increased profits. I think, as they're reporting their profits, but they're still, I think, a little afraid to hire and to make that full-time commitment. So they need to hire these entry-level new people, new grads coming out of school to help keep up with the demand of their business. So they are, coming to us for entry-level hires, recent college grads, people with 1 to 3 years experience is what we're seeing.
Could it be that, you know, companies in a tight time, they consolidate, people pick up different tasks, managers doing tasks that entry-level folks used to do, and now that things are getting a little better, there's more, perhaps profit is improving, that you say, okay, I'm not going to, I need somebody to help me with this task. Is that a realistic thing, what's happening in a company?
I mean, you saw, she mentioned increased profitability, and you are definitely seeing that across industries. And if you look at the work that people have been doing as the job losses mounted, everyone is working harder for less or for the same. And Americans have shown to be, you know, incredibly efficient at their jobs, but there becomes a point where the companies are just growing to the extent that the current staff just can't handle it anymore, and then they start the hiring. And I think what you're saying is you start with the temporary workers, you start with the entry-level workers, and then you just, as that demand builds, you convert them into full-time employers. I think that's generally how that works, right?
Yes, and I think, in July there were 14,000 temporary jobs added. So, I mean, that's a lot of hiring for the month of July. And also, I think there was a report out recently where productivity is decreasing among workers because we've had so much work has been put on people because companies wouldn't hire, that now they're needing to bring in staff to handle that productivity.
We're talking with Doug Buchanan from Business First and Katrina Roby from the staffing firm Dawson Careers. We're taking a look at the Central Ohio job market here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann. We welcome your calls at 292-8513. What's your assessment of the job picture here in Central Ohio? We'd like to hear from folks who are looking for a job and looking for employees. 292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Getting back to that whole efficiency thing, is there a chance, Doug, that we have learned this efficiency lesson too well during this recession and some of the jobs we lost will not come back because companies have learned how to be more productive?
Well, certainly that is going to be the case. But, I mean, I think that's a perennial issue that you're always going to change. I mean, that's what, you know, the creative destruction is all about. Businesses change, work dynamics change, and that is why employers so many times value flexible employees who can adapt to changing circumstances. One of the big problems you're seeing in the job market for the unemployed, and particularly the longer-term unemployed, is the skill sets are not matching what the companies are looking for. So whether it's efficiency or whether it's just a completely changing dynamic in the market, you need adaptability to be able to get a job and to be able to keep a job.
Are you seeing that?
I would definitely agree with that. Many employers, the skills have changed, the technical skills, the social media skills that employers are now seeking, because I think the environment has changed with the technology out there. So a lot of candidates we see in our offices, some of them do not meet the skill sets employers are looking for. And, there is training out there available, but it makes it, harder to search.
You hear a lot about this skills gap. Are employers less willing to train employees now, or is it because the labor market is such an employer-friendly market right now that they don't have to train? They can pick from the best of the bunch.
I think, it's starting to get, the employee market's starting to shrink. But earlier this year, yes, employers, could be very choosy and they would only select those candidates with that skill set. But in the Columbus area for June, unemployment was 6.2. You always consider a portion of that, those people out there unemployable. So the market's shrinking and employers are going to have to start re-looking at candidates and being willing to train them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if the employees with those skill sets just aren't out there, I mean they really don't have a choice. Now, I think that the for-profit, particularly the for-profit colleges, but all colleges in the higher education community has done a good job of getting together with industry to figure out what classes, what kinds of training programs are needed, and they're getting those students in there. But as Katrina says, at a certain point, if the people aren't there, you're going to have to train them yourself. An extreme example of that would be the casino.
Yeah.
They have several thousand people, that they need, and there's not, at least previously, there wasn't exactly schools for poker dealers out there, and so they've gone out and they've created those programs.
And they've partnered with local colleges.
Exactly, yeah. Columbus State, Hondros, and there's one more that, they are just funneling their employees through there.
We're speaking about the current job situation here in Central Ohio, here on 89.7 NPR News, All Sides with Ann Fisher. Doug Buchanan, which industries are hiring right now in Central Ohio?
Well, right now, the big announcement this week was the limited, put a call out there for 2,000 jobs. That was kind of the first big salvo for the holiday shopping season. Interestingly, a lot of those were distribution jobs. We're not talking about store employees. Number one, that's because they have a huge distribution complex here. But I think in general, you may not see the hiring in the stores that you may have seen in previous years because a lot of holiday shopping is moving online. And so it's strictly a distribution center kind of a atmosphere. And Central Ohio is poised to benefit from that. Obviously, we have a huge distribution and logistics industry here, which continues to grow. If you're looking for one of those kinds of jobs, the limited is looking to add them at the moment. So that was a big one.
What kind of jobs are those? Are those minimum wage jobs? Are they better paying jobs? More of a technical skills job?
They're mostly going to be like warehouse type positions, picking, packing, forklift drivers, that area. Mm-hmm. And I believe those wages are typically going to run somewhere between $10 to $12 an hour.
Mm-hmm. So it's about a little bit above a minimum wage.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Doug, one more industry besides the retail limited distribution, any other industry right now that you can point to that's
looking
good?
Well, again, I mentioned it earlier, but manufacturing, it's not the same as it used to be in Ohio. It may not ever get back there, but it is certainly a growing industry, and that's one of the reasons that our unemployment rate is lower than the national average, because the car companies and all of their suppliers and all of their related businesses. There's also polymer plastics operations across the state, aerospace engineering. I mean, there's a lot of projects. The Jobs Ohio report that came out yesterday indicated that there were several projects in those industries and in several industries that they had brought to Ohio that are adding hundreds of jobs across the state.
Jobs Ohio, the new name for the development office, quasi-private development office of the Kasich administration, reported there are 4,700 job commitments made by employers in Ohio, and they were touting that success.
And if you look at the job creation tax credits that the state gives out, as Katrina mentioned a minute ago, call centers are very big. If you look up in the Polaris area, even over in New Albany at their business park, they're having some large call centers that are being set up there. I mean, I think those are for a variety of industries. Katrina
right.
might know that a little bit more, but there's a lot of call center and kind of that back office technical jobs that are out there, and those would range from entry level, I think, to you know, pretty sophisticated tech IT jobs.
Does that mean more calls at dinner time, though?
That's a different industry.
Katrina, what are you seeing? What are you seeing?
What I'm seeing out in the marketplace is a lot of, like Doug has said, there's a lot of jobs in the call center arena, mm-hmm. Anywhere from retail companies ramping up for peak season. And then there's also companies that are, you know, bringing on large projects here in the area, and it could be from anything from settlements to, you know, medical and those arenas. And most of those positions out there in the call center we're seeing are paying for the entry level 12 to 14 an hour. But then there's a lot of opportunities for supervisors, managers. We're also seeing an uptick in IT hiring.
IT, because they have to support all these, whether it be logistics, call centers, anything. You need the IT folks to support.
Right, and I think you're going to see, and you have seen, IT jobs are going to be hot, and no matter what industry. I mean, we talked about efficiency a little bit ago for just, you know, general workers. Every industry, I mean, it would be hard-pressed to find one that was not touched by information technology and the needs to upgrade, change. And a lot of that work is done by these outside consulting firms. And they're always consistently fast growing, and they're always consistently looking for people, looking for those consultants to send into those businesses on a contract basis.
All right. Let's take a break. We'll continue with our picture, trying to get a snapshot of the job market here in Central Ohio when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. And your WOSU Public Media member card benefits are now even better with the member card benefit of the month. Each month, show your member card at selected partners for extra discounts. The WOSU member card benefit of the month for August is the Mill Run Movie Tavern. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission on selected days. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level and receive the WOSU member card as your gift. Just visit WOSU.org and thanks for your support.
Support for 89.7 comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
74 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today. Scattered showers and thunderstorms off and on throughout the day. A high in the mid-80s. More rain for tonight, a low of 68. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today on 89.7 NPR News. Our guest, Katrina Roby, she's Business Development Manager for Dawson Careers, a staffing firm here in Columbus. And Doug Buchanan, Managing Editor for Columbus Business First, the weekly business newspaper and also robust online reporting on the business community here in Twitter. You're even tweeting now.
Yes, Twitter, Facebook, we're trying to, as Katrina says, stay relevant to the changing economy.
We're getting a look at the job picture here in Central Ohio. Some signs of life, some signs of optimism. Let's hope it stays and hope it expands. We talked briefly about healthcare and the biotech industry. Katie, what are you have clients in that industry, and what are they looking for?
In the healthcare industry, we do quite a bit of work in that arena, and all areas of that we are seeing growth. I think healthcare is going to continue to be in demand, you know, for the next several years.
So nurses,
Techs, doctors, you know, down to like records clerks and you know, lab techs, anywhere in those areas.
Doug, that's one of the areas in this economy that has really continued to grow, maybe slower than it was, but it's continued to grow through this recession.
But yeah, correct. I mean, we have seen healthcare industry the jobs grow. Yeah, it really showed no signs of problems. I mean, yes, it may have slowed a little bit. And the thing about the Supreme Court upholding the Affordable Care Act is now, I think there's very little doubt that something, some changes are coming. Obviously, the November elections will be the next big hurdle, but you're going to see significant changes in the healthcare industry. And assuming that the Affordable Care Act stays, you're going to see huge growth in the industry as all of these new patients get covered and they're going to start looking for care. And as Katrina mentioned, it goes up and down. I mean, there will definitely be a shortage of doctors. And then, you know, all the way down into the electronic medical records arena, which is also part of the ACA, there's going to be needs in just about every sector in healthcare. But again, that may be, you know, certainly that's happening now, but that may be a little bit more of a long-term job forecast.
When you just look at the three, four big hospitals in town, and the Children's Hospital just opened a new facility. OSU is building one. Riverside Ohio Health plans to build one. Mount Carmel has plans to expand. You got to have people who work in those buildings.
Right. And the thing is that if you look, I mean, yes, they're definitely having the big flagship towers here downtown. But Mount Carmel, Ohio Health, I mean, they're both building outpatient facilities. Everett Children's is doing that. Ohio State's doing that. I mean, you're seeing the spread of the healthcare community, the healthcare industry going all out into the suburbs and into the cities as outpatient becomes more critical to their operations. So, yeah, they need people to fill jobs all over the different parts of their business, but then geographically it'll be spread out as well.
Katrina Roby from Dawson Staffing, what's the labor pool like? Are there enough people qualified to fill these jobs in healthcare? Some of these jobs are very specialized and need a lot of training.
Right. You know, there's certain segments that it is hard to find candidates who have the education and the training for these positions. So it is, you know, it is harder to find these people, and you have to search sometimes outside of Ohio for specialized positions. And there are employers that are willing to pay the relocation costs to bring them here. So, I mean, there's definitely good opportunity for people looking to go back to school in that healthcare arena.
The shale gas industry, it's gotten a lot of attention. It's starting to get going now, and that holds great promise.
It does, but you know, again, we've been looking at the kind of the infrastructure of shale in eastern Ohio, and it's not there yet. I mean, we just have not been a big drilling state. There certainly has been some activity, but the amount of shale or the amount of oil and gas they're talking about pulling out there requires processing plants and pipelines. And if you're looking at jobs, there are going to be a lot of jobs building that up. For now, but really, I think that the big job growth in shale, assuming that the projections hold, are still going to be a couple of years off. Even though, you know, right now you're seeing hiring as Halliburton sets up and Chesapeake Energy sets up. You know, this is happening in eastern Ohio, but still, I would imagine that you know that job growth will have those ancillary benefits, just like you would see in auto manufacturing.
I mean, the numbers projections by 2014, OSU says 20,000 jobs in the shale industry. The shale industry itself says they project 66,000 jobs.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania has seen 238,000 jobs directly attributed to this industry. Is it too hopeful to think that we could see that many jobs 10 years? Because they're about 10 years ahead of us.
They are ahead of us, and obviously more of the shale lies underneath their state. But still, you know, whether it's and some of that depends on how exactly you count a direct and indirect job, but you know, I don't think that as long as the geologists are right as far as what is down there, whatever the final number is, I don't think you can overestimate the impact that it will have, especially on those communities in eastern Ohio that were hurt by the loss of steel. I mean, you're already seeing steel coming back somewhat because of it, but it's really just going to be the transformation of that eastern Ohio economy in general.
Talking about the Central Ohio job market here on All Sides with Ann Fisher, give us a call, 292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. An email from Fran. Katrina, I'm going to give this to you. Are local companies using more temporary staffing on a permanent basis? Is it becoming more acceptable in the professional arena to use temporary workers and not hire full-timers? Katrina Roby.
Yes, I would agree that a lot of employers are using temporary agencies for their hiring. And I think one reason is that, you know, with the way the economy has been, it's improving, but there's still uncertainty, and I think until the election in November. Plus, you know, a lot of employers, they've gotten used to temporary hiring. They like that opportunity to, you know, see how someone is going to fit into their company before they make that full-time hiring decision.
Is it the same bellwether that it has been, that the more temporary workers are hired, it's going to lead to permanent hires down the road, or is that not the case anymore?
No, it still is. I mean, I would say probably 65% of our candidates that come in our door that we place end up hired full-time with that company. And a lot of, I think temporary hiring is a good way to go because we see a lot of openings that are never advertised. And we may, you know, you may not have the exact skill set, but we're able to speak to that employer. We've met you, interviewed you, and to promote your background and say, we think this person would be a great fit culturally, skill-wise within your organization.
You know, this idea of openings that are never advertised, I mean, that's another problem that you talk about. If you're long-term unemployed, is getting hired into a company because there is that stigma for people who are out of the job market. And so whether temporary hiring has increased or if it's here to stay, I mean, it is one way to – it is definitely an avenue toward a full-time job that may not be available to somebody who hasn't had any job for, you know, months or for years.
It's a way to help fill that gap in that resume, which a lot of people have right now.
Right.
The construction industry, any movement there? I mean, for a while there, it was huge. You couldn't turn a corner without seeing a construction site. Now, not so much, but there are signs maybe that the building is coming back?
Yeah, there are signs that it's coming back, maybe more on the commercial side of things. I mean, residential, you still have this glut of homes. The situation there has improved. I mean, dramatically with home sales. But still, when you talk about building new homes, you're just not going to see like it was 5 or 6 years ago. If ever, it's going to be quite a long time. But on the commercial side, yes, you are seeing an uptick in construction. So that employment is starting to come back. But again, that's one that that has really been lagging, and it's been more of a drag than anything else.
Financial services, Katrina, what is the situation looking like there with financial services professionals? Openings there?
There are. It is, I think it's an increasing market right now. This year, there was one employer here in the Columbus market in the financial services arena that has added about 400 people to their facility. So, and I know Chase is continuing to hire here in the market, and several other financial services companies. So it is becoming more competitive out there to find those candidates with that background.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about, we're not talking about tellers. I mean, we're talking about back office. There are just some enormous operations here, JP Morgan Chase being the biggest example up at Polaris. But lots of banks, Citigroup has something here. I mean, they're kind of nondescript buildings. But these are lots of jobs.
Decent paying jobs, too.
And decent pay, right, exactly.
Good benefits.
Right. That should continue because, again, we have a good location for it. They're not going to be putting those back office jobs over on the East Coast. They're going to be moving them in, and we have good land. We have good networks for it. So I would anticipate that would still be a good market.
We're speaking about the Central Ohio jobs picture with Doug Buchanan, managing editor for Columbus Business First, and Katrina Roby, business development manager for Dawson Careers, a staffing firm here in town. An email from Jeremiah. What are the most challenging types of jobs or skill sets in the Central Ohio is having the most difficulty filling?
Some of the areas where we're having difficulty is in the IT technology for programmers, developers that are very specific. Also in the creative field, some of those positions for certain designers and project managers, if it's a specific skill set, it's definitely a harder find for that candidate.
I would echo IT because again the skills that are necessary are specific and changing, and you could have somebody who was up to date 2 years ago, and who maybe has not found work and falls behind very quickly. And so for the IT staffing firms, for the IT consulting firms out there to find people who fit exactly what they need and exactly what those companies need, that can get increasingly difficult very quickly.
So what should an IT person, what should a job seeker who's in that field do? What does somebody who's not in that field who wants to get into that, what should they do?
I think someone that's not in that field that wants to get into it, the first thing is, to go back to school and get the training and education that would be needed. That may take some time, but, if you get the proper training, there's some excellent opportunities that pay well.
Do you need a bachelor's degree? Will a two-year degree at Columbus State do it? Will it just be a training course, for 6 or 8 weeks, intense on a certain programming language? I mean, what kind of training are we talking about here?
I would say, for the higher level, more specific positions, definitely a bachelor's degree. But then there's other more of that mid-level, entry-level IT that, two-year degree, would definitely be sufficient to help you land that position.
And training programs are out there. I mean, they're not the schools that offer these training programs, and they're businesses.
Yep.
If there was no need for their specific training program, they'd drop it. I think that there are definitely training programs out there. And as we discussed earlier, you can't overestimate the importance of just getting some kind of work and staying in there. And there's nothing like firsthand knowledge of what skills are what's needed. And there's no better way to do it than just hands-on when you're actually in a workplace and you've got other people there who you can talk to and learn from.
And if you get into a workplace, the company will train you. I mean, they want a certain basic level of training, but if a new language comes out or a new protocol comes out, they're going to send you to a conference or they're going to hook
right,
you up with a
right,
training session
right.
here.
Right. I mean, the reason that there's the stigma about the people who are out of work now. I mean, once you get somebody into your workplace and they show that they're competent and they have all the skills that you need, then they're going to have that natural advantage of the employer wanting to keep them. And as you said, they'll do what it takes to make sure that person can stay and be productive.
For folks who are not in the IT world, what advice do you give them to either get a job if they're unemployed or advance their career if they want to move up?
I think one of the biggest things is a lot of people that we meet with at our office, they come in, they maybe have been unemployed for a while, and they've been very specific as to what they're wanting, and they've turned down opportunities. But my advice is to take that opportunity, get your foot in the door. It may not be at the level of pay you are seeking, but get your foot in the door, show that employer what you're capable of doing. And, 90% of the time that leads to better opportunities within that company. If you're a reliable and excellent employee, it leads to bigger things.
Has the face of the person who's seeking a job, describe how that's changed over the past year, 2 years. What type of people are you seeing now that you weren't seeing before and vice versa?
I think, as always, we see a lot of, recent college graduates, but probably the way it's changed is a lot of people who were, farther ahead in their career, maybe had been with their position 20, 25 years and were downsized. And that's very hard for that person to go out and seek work. They have an interview. Their interviewing skills may not be where they were, their networking skills. But, I think for those people, get out there, use your network of who you know, and don't be afraid.
Are you seeing fewer of those people, the fewer of the long-term unemployed coming in now, or is it the same percentage, same rate?
I would say we're seeing fewer of the unemployed, that's been employed for a year or longer. Mm-hmm. The one thing, though, people I think are starting to accept positions because unemployment is running out.
Yep.
And it's changing.
Yeah, you're seeing that in the unemployment numbers. Obviously, if you're not looking for work anymore, they don't count you. And so as you look at that unemployment number from month to month, the number of people who are actually actively looking for work keeps changing and keeps affecting that number. And there are still a lot of them out there. And as the job market finally starts to turn around, I think you will start seeing more of these long-term unemployed actively getting back in the game and trying for work. So, that's going to be a problem that's not going to be resolved for a good long while.
We keep hearing a lot about the uncertainty surrounding the financial cliff, which happens at the end of the year, where mm-hmm. Congress will have to make $1.2 trillion in cuts, tax increases may take place. Are employers worried about that, Doug, and putting off hiring perhaps because of that?
Well, that specifically, I don't know that that specifically is what it is. But over the past however number of years now, it's been one crisis after another. You could point to Europe and the problems because if they go into the tank, we're going to be severely affected by that as well. There's always a number of worries that you could point to stop you from hiring. I just think it's just more generally the direction of the economy that they're looking for.
Katrina, the election. Is election, how does this compare to previous election cycles? There's always some uncertainty, especially in a tumultuous point like this, an election year causes uncertainty.
Right. No, it always causes some uncertainty with employers. I've been in the staffing industry for 20 years, and I've seen different cycles and changes in the environment. But I think it affects it. For our industry, it usually increases temporary hiring because there's uncertainty and people they're not ready to make that full-time commitment.
And when does the uncertainty subside? Is it right after Election Day? Is it after Inauguration Day? When is the uncertainty, if it ever does subside?
I don't know if it ever ends because there's always changes happening and different, policies and.
I think you need to see momentum in the economy before it will start building on itself, and we just have not been able to get that momentum. You'd have a couple of months of solid jobs gains, and then it'll go back to the economy created 10,000 or whatever low number it was, I think if you start seeing a string of those put together, that will build on itself. Whatever the circumstances are elsewhere with the election or whatever else. But, it just has not happened. And I don't know that we're going to see that before November or before fiscal cliff at the end of the year.
All right. Doug Buchanan, Managing Editor for Business First here in Columbus. Thanks very much. Katrina Roby, Business Development Manager for Dawson Careers, a staffing firm here in Columbus. Thanks very much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we return, we'll take a look at segregation, neighborhood segregation based on income. It's increasing here in Columbus and across the country. That's when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Chris Rock. He stars opposite Julie Delpy in the new film comedy, 2 Days in New York. He's also producing a new comedy show on the FX network called Totally Biased. Chris Rock on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And when you support our station at the annual level of $85, our gift to you is the WOSU Public Media Member Card. The Member Card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 200 Member Card partners in and around Central Ohio. Save money and support 89.7 NPR News with the WOSU Member Card. Make a gift of $85 or more. Visit WOSU.org/membercard for more information. 74 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today with scattered showers and thunderstorms. More rain for tonight, a low of 68 degrees. Partly sunny with a chance of morning rain on Friday, then some sunshine in the afternoon, a high of 74. Cloudy for Friday night and comfortable temperatures, a low of 57 degrees. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A new Pew Research study found that neighborhood segregation by income is more likely now than it was in the 1980s. The study took census tracts, labeled them as upper income or lower income areas, and looked at who was living in those neighborhoods. What it found is that poor neighborhoods had a higher percentage of poor residents than they did in the 80s, and rich neighborhoods had a higher percentage of upper income residents, thus the increased segregation. Columbus got one of the worst rankings, 8th highest income segregation in the country, just behind Detroit, as far as the Midwest is concerned. To help us understand what this all means, we welcome Emily Badger, who writes about cities and public policy for the Atlantic Cities, which is part of Atlantic Magazine. Emily, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Income segregation has been a reality since there were railroad tracks and people decided on which side of those tracks they wanted to live. Why is this study surprising?
Well, I think the story of growing income inequality in America is a fairly sort of old story, and a lot of people are familiar with it. I mean, we've been listening to the Occupy Wall Street movement talk about this for the last year or so. And, you know, in fact, this is a trend that's been growing for about 3 decades now, that income is not distributed across the population as evenly as it used to be. But what's so new and unusual that this Pew study reveals for us is that, you know, these trends in how income is distributed are also reflecting themselves in where we live in cities. And, you know, in a sense, as we're moving apart on the income spectrum, we're also sort of moving apart from each other in cities so that people are increasingly sort of self-segregated, so that poor people are more likely to be living in communities that are predominantly poor, and rich people are more likely to be living in communities that are predominantly have rich neighbors as well. And, you know, sort of the other side of this coin, what this also means is that fewer and fewer of us are living in communities that are mixed income and that are predominantly middle income.
So why is this worth watching? Why is it important to have mixed income neighborhoods?
Well, I think, you know, the notion that we're self-segregating according to income is part of this sort of broader notion that in many ways Americans are sort of sorting themselves out into like-minded communities so that, you know, I'm more likely to live in a neighborhood that has, you know, other people of my age, other people of my political leaning, other people of my income, other people of my race. And I think the notion that Americans, because we think of ourselves as being such a diverse country, that within that diverse country, we would all be living in these sort of, you know, very homogenous enclaves where we're not interacting with each other. You know, I think that this is a notion that would sort of offend a lot of people's sense of the idea that diversity is important and that we get a lot of benefits from diversity and from interacting with each other and living side by side with each other.
We're speaking about segregation of neighborhoods by income. It's on the increase, according to a new study. We welcome your thoughts. Do you live in a mixed income neighborhood? Why do you live there? Have you moved out of a mixed income neighborhood? And why did you move? Our phone number is 292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can also check us out and continue the conversation on Twitter and on Facebook. You noted this affects middle-class neighborhoods. In 1980, 85% of our neighborhoods were considered middle-class across the country. Now it's down to 76% of our neighborhoods are considered middle-class.
Yeah, I mean, to me, those are still really impressively high numbers. I mean, we're still talking about the vast majority of Americans in American cities living in neighborhoods that either have a mix of income or that have predominantly middle income. So it's not so much that we're talking about all of us are living in these sort of economically segregated enclaves, but the thing that's sort of concerning is that that number has dropped by about 10 percentage points over the last three decades. So we're sort of seeing this, you know, not just a snapshot in time of 2010 when Americans are living this way, but the fact that there's this growing trend developing over the last three decades. And, you know, the other thing that's particularly interesting about this is that over the last three decades, we've actually seen racial segregation in American cities decline, but at the same time, racial segregation is declining. This other type of economic segregation is increasing.
Emily Badger is a writer with The Atlantic Cities. We're talking about segregation of neighborhoods by income. Emily, what's happening? Are upper-income people moving to more exclusive neighborhoods, or are middle-class people leaving lower-income neighborhoods?
I think a large part of it has to do with a lot of upper-income people moving into predominantly upper-income neighborhoods. You know, this is partly the case in Columbus, for instance. I mean, the reason why Columbus did so sort of poorly on this metric that the Pew Research Report came up with is because the extent to which upper-income families in Columbus are sort of living amongst themselves is much higher now than it was about 30 years ago. And the reasons why this is happening are very different in different parts of the country. It has to do with sort of exactly what the local zoning laws are or what type of real estate development has been going on, all sorts of very kind of locally specific policy issues. But I think one of the kind of bigger trends that we can look at, and this may have something to do with what's going on in Columbus, is that over the last 20, 30 years or so, we have really seen a lot of new development in sort of suburban subdivisions. And a lot of times these are communities with, you know, $500,000 houses, which are inaccessible to low-income or even some middle-income families. And so by creating these types of subdivisions, we're basically creating communities where only upper-income people can live. And so it's not very surprising to find in these types of new developments, which we didn't have 30 years ago, that there's a lot of sort of wealthy income segregation there.
I assume the housing boom had something to do with that. Because it slowed, obviously, in the last 5 years. But, you know, for much of the past 30 years, there was a lot of sprawl, a lot of new developments, a lot of new housing construction.
Yeah, I mean, almost all of when we talk about the housing boom, what we're talking about is exactly this type of development. We're talking about suburban development. We're talking about you know, these subdivisions in the suburbs that were built particularly to draw sort of middle class and upper income families out of cities. And if you look at sort of the long sweep of population trends over time, it used to be that, you know, we would have all types of different people living in the city, but increasingly as upper income people have moved out to the suburbs, what that's left is exclusive pockets of lower-income people who are left in cities who just don't have quite the mobility and the options to move that wealthier families do.
We're speaking with Emily Badger. She's a writer with The Atlantic Cities. We're talking about income segregation here in Columbus and across the country. It's on the rise, according to a new Pew study. The Southwest, according to Pew, had the largest largest increase in segregation. And from what I read, immigration played a role in that.
Yeah, well, one of the things that jumped out at me from this report that is really sort of notable is that the three cities that have the worst income segregation today in America are all in Texas. These are Dallas, Fort Worth area, and Houston and San Antonio. And I think that, you know, it's not a coincidence that this has happened. I mean, these are cities that have had tremendous population growth over the last 30 years. I mean, one of the few sort of trends that Pew was able to pull out of this is that a lot of the cities that are having worsening income segregation are cities that have had expanding populations. And when we're looking at a state like Texas, part of what we're looking at when we look at expanding population is that they've had both an influx of sort of wealthy retiree people who are looking to move to the Sun Belt, but at the same time, at the other end of the income spectrum, they've had an influx of kind of low-skill, low-wage immigrants. And so, you know, the population of those cities has changed over time such that they now have these kind of two big groups of people living there now who are in totally opposite ends of the income spectrum, and in many ways, because these are newer cities that have just been developed most significantly over the last 20 or 30 years, you know, real estate developers have really built communities there specifically for these upper-income communities.
Yeah, so if you're moving to a new city, you're looking for a place where you want to live with people who are quote like us. I mean, to lack of a better term, it affects the population growth, the higher population growth cities. Columbus, you could count in that, not as high as Texas, but our population has grown as well over the past 30 years.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, according to the data that Pew looked at, and they were pulling out census data from 1980, 1990, 2000, and 2010, over those 30 years or so, I think the population in the Columbus metropolitan area, this is not just the city proper, but includes the suburbs, has grown by about 50%. So I think you might know a little bit better than I do exactly where that growth has taken place, but I'm going to guess that a lot of it is at the suburban fringe.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's slowed certainly since the housing slowdown, but yeah, there was a lot of farm fields have houses on them now, and even more so since I came to town just 10 or 15 years ago. We're speaking with Emily Badger. She writes for the Atlantic Cities about segregation by income in our neighborhoods here in Columbus and across the nation. What about older cities, Emily? Detroit has a worse ranking than Columbus does, but also cities like Boston, Cleveland, Chicago. What are we seeing in those cities?
Well, you know, older cities are when we talk about how a lot of these cities have different reasons for why these segregation statistics look different, a lot of it has to do with sort of the original settlement patterns and how people settled in these cities and the way that real estate was developed in the first place. And communities in older cities in the Northeast were just laid out very differently from these communities in Texas, where, you know, they had the ability to sort of plan communities in a much more sort of intentional way than the kind of chaotic and natural way that Northeastern cities were planned. And so I think that, you know, we see this effect a little bit less in some of these cities in the Northeast, although New York certainly ranks pretty high up there, particularly having a lot of its low-income people segregated in low-income areas. But there's definitely sort of something to the kind of historical patterns of how cities were built in the first place that we see reflected in these statistics, 100, sometimes 200 years later.
When you look at Detroit, that's where you see, I think you look at the stats that the so-called middle-class neighborhoods have, the percentage of them have shrunk. I assume in Detroit that's the poster child of because of the decline in the auto industry up there, that you've seen an erosion of the middle-class neighborhood, quote-unquote.
Yeah, I mean, this is not just about the rise of upper-income enclaves and the rise of lower-income enclaves. It's also about sort of the decline of middle-class communities. And in many cases, this isn't just because people are moving around. It's because literally, you know, the middle class itself is shrinking and getting smaller. And that's certainly the case in Detroit. A lot of times, you know, historically, when we're talking about the middle class, particularly in this part of the country, we're talking about, you know, people who worked in factory jobs, perhaps in the auto industry, but they were relatively well high-paying jobs that you didn't necessarily have to have a lot of education for. And these are exactly the types of jobs that don't really exist anymore. And so I think, you know, what we're seeing in Detroit is both that, you know, upper-income people, wealthier people have had the option to move out of the city, and so they have. But at the same time, the middle class itself is just getting smaller.
I wonder if we're heading more closer to the norm as far as American history goes now than we'd had from the 1950s to the 1980s when we saw an explosion in the middle class, what was the income segregation like, you know, before World War II? I mean, was it more like it is now? Was it even worse than it is now?
Well, you know, the Pew report only goes back to about 1980 in part because they didn't have the census data to look at this before then. But, you know, I think most of the housing trends that we would be talking about predating World War II really have more to do with racial segregation than they do with income segregation, although oftentimes those two things are one and the same, such that a predominantly African-American neighborhood might also be a predominantly low-income neighborhood. But, you know, I think our frame of reference for sort of understanding how people sorted themselves out and self-segregated prior to the kind of post-war housing boom and the shift in population out to the suburbs really did have more to do with this notion of kind of racial segregation. Mm-hmm. And I think, it's kind of important to sort of step back for a minute and realize that even though we're talking about how income segregation is on the rise, it's still not as dramatic and as pervasive as racial segregation in America is. I mean, that's still a much larger phenomenon than what we're talking about here, but because that phenomenon is on the decline and this phenomenon is increasing, that's sort of cause for concern, I think.
Just a few minutes left with Emily Badger, a writer with Atlantic Cities. We're talking about the Pew study that shows that income segregation by neighborhood has increased over the past 30 years. Emily, I don't want to catch you off guard, but how did we compare to other developed countries in the world? Do you know?
You know, I don't know that. This report in particular didn't look at that. Mm-hmm. But I am aware, though, that the kind of broader statistics about the rise of inequality in general in the economy are certainly much starker in the United States than they are in other countries. But particularly as to this question about sort of how that trend reflects itself in the way that we live and where we live and who we live with, I think that would be a really interesting question to look at, particularly because a lot of other countries, particularly in Europe, the cities there are much older. They have had very different development patterns. You're not going to have a city like Texas, which was sort of born after a city in Texas, which was born kind of after the automobile and air conditioning and developed in a very different way. You're not going to have that type of city in Paris, for instance. So I think that would be very interesting to see, and I'm sure it would look dramatically different, but I don't know exactly what it would look like.
Any chance this is a temporary blip because of the Great Recession and the sharp downturn in the economy over the past 5 years?
I do not think so, especially because this is a trend that has developed over the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, this picture that Pew is showing is one that takes snapshots at each decade over the last 30 years or so. If anything, I think the recession probably stalled this trend and kept it from becoming even more dramatic.
So this has been happening even during the good times of the 1990s. We saw more of this segregation.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, it makes sense. If you have more money, you can buy a bigger house and you can get
further
separated from...
We don't want to necessarily fault wealthy families for choosing to live in wealthy communities. That's certainly their right to do, but there have certainly been more opportunities for them to do that since the housing boom.
Are urban planners, city leaders worried about this?
Yeah, I think this is absolutely a cause for concern. I mean, for sort of philosophical reasons, I think a lot of people are sort of worried about this notion that we increasingly just want to live in sort of homogenous communities with our own types of people. But there's also just sort of the kind of logistical financial concern that cities don't want all of their upper-income people fleeing out to the suburbs. I mean, these are people who pay taxes. These are people who open businesses. These are people who pay property taxes. And for a whole host of reasons, cities are very actively invested in trying to get a lot of these people to return into cities where they might in many cases be living in more mixed income neighborhoods.
In particular for urban planners like City of Columbus rather than the suburbs, is it realistic to think that you can create neighborhoods that are a mix of, you know, upper income housing and say subsidized housing in the same block?
Yeah, I think this is absolutely realistic. I mean, it's the case in many cities right now that if you're a real estate developer and you want to put up a new, say, 10-story apartment building, the city might very well tell you, you know, we're only going to give you a permit to do this if 10% of the units in it go to affordable housing. So there are sort of active policy tools that cities are using to try to ensure that that various neighborhoods throughout cities are open and accessible to people of all income stripes. But also just when we're talking about communities that are so much more dense in the city than they are in the suburbs, it's quite possible, and I experienced this in my own neighborhood, that I only have to walk a couple blocks away to see what's essentially public housing and then walk another couple blocks and see, mansions that cost $800,000 a year or so. And that's just not the type of development that you would see in the suburbs, but it continues to exist in denser urban settings.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Emily Badger from Atlantic Cities Magazine. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. We're streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News is a service of WOSU Public Media.